from tragedy to triumph. Hosted by Aaron Lane.
You ready to do this?
I'm ready.
We're just going to jump in.
Let's do it.
3, 2, 1. Hey, everyone. Welcome to this special episode of Tragedy to Triumph. I have one of my favorite guests of all time back in the building, Mr. Tom Sinan. So, Tom, welcome back. How are you today?
I'm doing good. One of my favorite hosts. This is great. I love doing this.
I think it's funny how these things, we were just talking about beforehand, like the craziness of life and how the more we involve ourselves in the advocacy work, and it kind of takes us away from what we thought our original responsibilities were going to be. And here we are now kind of, you know, circling back around. We're going to talk about some of these things, what we're doing, how this year has been, both in your life and mine. And then maybe just build upon that to fly by the seat of our pants and kind of, you know, go from there.
That's the best way to do it.
It's no rhyme to reason.
No plans. Let's just go.
Yeah, I got to take a deep breath. I was telling Tom before he got in here, like, today has been wild. I had to be here at 6 a.m. and then that went to another job. Kids are going crazy. I have more responsibilities after this. And the thing was, a couple of years ago, I can remember sitting in jail. I can remember clamoring for, like, let me just sit in traffic. Let me have problems with my family that I can be there in the moment. And now they're happening, right? And I have to remind myself of the day that I desperately wanted what I have right now. So, you ever go through that yourself? Like, you ever look at this whole thing?
I think sometimes I go, man, this is hectic. I want to go to jail and get a vacation.
Right. Kind of just, you know, that
there's
way
too
you
much
know,
going on.
I know, it's wild. And this week, where are you headed to this week?
D.C. I'll be back in D.C. I was there last week. I've been doing a lot of trips to D.C. They've been a lot more involved from not only the congressional side, but also the federal side, the agencies, National Institute of Justice, and a few others that are doing studies and research. And really wanting to get involved. And they're talking to the people on the street from all around the country saying,
wow,
what can we do better? We want to hear some of your hurdles. What are some of the things that you think are making an impact? And how can we replicate those? And what do you need from us? So it's been pretty fascinating. But I go back next week and it's the PARI Summit, Law Enforcement Summit. And they're out of Massachusetts. They do stuff like connect social workers with law enforcement and ANGEL program, the LEADS program. Very big on diversion programs. How can we deal with treatment from another perspective other than just sticking them in jail and then throwing away the key? Is there a way that we can get people into treatment first and then use that instead of just the jail process? So they've been really good with that stuff, and they have a strong connection with D.C. It's the first time they'll be in D.C. Usually it's in Boston. But the first day we go down, we'll meet with the drug czar, have a briefing in the Eisenhower House on the White House grounds. So,
dude,
really looking forward to that. That's such a cool building. I love D.C., one, because of the history in the building. So the Eisenhower building is this really cool building. So I'm looking forward to that. And then I speak Thursday. All the events are on Capitol Hill meeting rooms. So there's going to be congressional staff members, people from Congress, senators, hopefully coming in and out and talking about how can we make a difference and how can we work together. So a lot bigger response on the federal side.
Dude, I mean, I'll tell you, first and foremost, like, the fact you're even doing these things, it's like, it's mind-blowing, mind-boggling to me that here we are. I mean, this is an important role to take and to be representative of not only community, but, you know, the voice of people who struggle and law enforcement. I mean, there's so many moving parts, things we've talked about in the past. But the word that's always funny to me is drug czar. And I know that that's something that's been implemented for a long time. And what we have someone who's newly appointed to that role, correct? And they have to be brought up to speed. Is that kind of the idea?
James Carroll is the new drug czar, but the official title is Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. So you start understanding why you get a nickname. Because
exactly.
In D.C., there's all these initials and they all stand for these big, long names. But I think he's been there for about a year.
Okay.
I sit on ONDCP calls. They have a monthly kind of briefing, intelligence call, kind of give us what's going on around the country with the drugs. And one of the first calls, he was there and kind of spoke about what his vision is. But it's a position out of the White House, so they're trying to figure out what should be the policy of the White House
and
a national response. So for them, and you know, it's strange because being in this position and advocating, now I get to help influence some of that policy, me and many others, on a national side with the White House, National Security Council, Homeland Security, and they're coming to us and they're saying, what are you guys doing? What do you need? How can we help? So the response from the federal government has actually been really good, especially the past couple of years. Big when you're talking about the STOP Act, which Senator Portman worked on and testified in that committee.
Yeah, that's true.
For fentanyl coming through the mail, the CURES grants, the CARA grants, CARA Grant 2.0, helping get people into treatment, get more access to treatment. So they're really looking at, and this is what's kind of neat. It is truly a bipartisan issue. When I was down there last week, we were meeting with some congressional staffers, and they told us, look, the Congress people It's a bipartisan issue to them, and just about everyone has been impacted. So you will see these congressional staffers, they're young kids, but they're going to be very interested in what's going on. What we were discussing was they were introducing legislation that would not replace opiates, but from a surgical side, are there other things that could be done, non-opiate alternatives, such as nerve blocks, ibuprofen, pain medication that's non-addictive, therapies, that type of thing. Apparently, there is some legislation that allows opiates to kind of be the significant one and get reimbursed highly. So it's low cost and they get reimbursed high. So financially, it's significant. But what this bill would do, it's Voices for Non-Opiate Alternatives. What it would do is allow for the non-opiate alternatives to be kind of on the same playing field as the opiate ones. Have doctors give a choice to patients, have a little bit more discussion on this. Look, you can't get rid of opiates because there is a place for them.
Right.
We can't go from one extreme to the other. But are there ways we can do things better? These young kids came in, these congressional staffers, and first of all, I was shocked because the room was packed. And these are young kids, 19, 20-year-old kids that are working on these congressional staffs. And we sat there and had these open discussions about the opiate epidemic, the alternatives, all these different things. And they were all so attentive, taking notes, on their phone taking notes, going back and communicate with their congresspeople saying, hey, this is a project that's being worked on. This is what we're hearing from the people on the street. And what was fascinating was that afterwards we did a question and answer, and they had so many good questions on what is success to you, which like you,
right,
and,
you and I talked about right before we started this.
I'm not a big fan of that word because when you say success, it's almost as if you figured everything out and it's finalized.
Right.
And addiction is so complex and there's so many layers to it that I don't know if we can go and say success. What we're really looking for is can we reduce the impact addiction has on the individual, the family, the communities, and the country. But it was a very open conversation. Hey, you define what you think success is. And I came back with that. And they're like, yeah, that's been one of the problems. But I also said, you as Congress are putting a lot of pressure on treatment and all these other people because you're saying you need to be successful. And in reality, what is true success from addiction? If we know it takes 7 to 8 times on average for the opiate addicted person to get it through treatment, if it takes 1 to 3 years, can we say that you go through one time and you're quote unquote successful? Probably not. But Congress is putting a lot of pressure, and I understand some of it because they're putting tax money and they're saying, wait,
they need to quantitate that. They need to say, this is the measure that we're saying is success.
It's got to be accountable. Right. You got to have some accountability so that you can go back to the taxpayers and say, we're not wasting your money. But in that, like we always talk about, for every good, there's a bad. The bad with that is you're forcing people to show success in order to keep their doors open.
Yeah.
Which is not good.
So it causes it, right. So what, because what people tend to do in those types of situations is fudge the numbers enough to where they're saying, look, this is what we're looking at here.
Well, a lot of times with a number, you're trying to tell a story. And if you're trying to tell a story of success, you use a lot of times percentages where 70 to 80% successful is the term I constantly hear. And my thing, and this is what I told the congressional staffers, you should be willing to let people fail. Because when people fail, then we find out where the gaps are. I would much rather a treatment facility come back and go, look, man, honestly, our success rate is 10 to 20%. What do you need from us? What could help you do that?
You're going to be sitting on that one for a while then. I mean, do you really anticipate someone's going to say, oh, we have a 10 to 20% success
rate? That's the reality of it.
I mean, I know, I agree with you, but you know, from our conversations and in knowledge of what's going on, to be able to say, for someone to be bold enough to do that, and it is real and it is honest, because guess what? That is, the numbers are a lot less. And there's no guarantee and all these different things that I understand, you understand, but to be able to stand there and would the government and people with the backing financially be able to say, okay, well then let's keep throwing that money at till we find something. Is that kind of the idea?
Well, even the evidence-based research is extremely low. And part of that is addiction in itself. Part of that is us as a system. You're right. Is it going to happen? Probably not. But like I told the congressional staffers, if we did that, what we would find out is where are the gaps in the system and what do we need to do better.
That's smart.
What can we get more resources to? You're doing the exact opposite of what you want to do from a congressional side. If you're saying you must meet this standard, my standard is Congress, here's what I set it as, and now you're forcing people to, like you said, now I've got to either up my program to a point that's unrealistic, or I'm failing those I'm serving. Because I'm not able to give them the service that they really need. And what it really is, it's long-term continuum care. So a lot of times we look at a system just in pieces and go, well, this piece needs to be 70% successful. If you're not, you're a failure. And then we go on through the next pieces. When in reality is if each piece, even if it was 10 to 20%, if the whole system was 10 to 20% within individuals, we would be 70 to 80% successful as a whole system. Sure. But we're not looking at that whole system part. So that's what I told them, is your pressure is making people forced to do certain things within just that individual group. And then what's the next step? And then you look at them and go, well, wait a minute, you didn't succeed, so we're cutting off your money. When in reality, they probably did. What if they were 10 to 20% successful and we had a continuum care system that was connected and the next one was 10 to 20%? Now we're at 20 to 40%. What if the next system was 10 to 20%? Now we're at 40 to 60%. Now we start connecting all these pieces.
And start doing that. Okay.
And it was fascinating because they really picked up on that. And it was obvious it was an issue. I'm sure they're struggling within the funding sources and saying, what is a realistic number? What pressure are we putting on people, and what pressure are we forcing people to tell a different story than what's really happening? But what else was fascinating was a young lady come up afterwards, and she goes, look, my whole family deals with addiction. I just lost my cousin 2 weeks ago, overdosed and died. So you really start seeing the impact.
The humanity of it, too.
Yeah, and the impact it has on everybody. So I think this is the moment we can shift the conversation. And we can start saying we need to do a better job as a system, locally from the street, the state, and then from Congress. How can we connect these systems? Ultimately, what you want to do, in my opinion, is make sure it gets into the mental medical health system that is treated as a chronic condition. That's the other message, that when you're piecemealing this together and when Congress is saying that on grant that you have to be 70% successful, what you're really doing is taking away from the ability for that person to grow into active recovery. It's not, you're forcing the system to be so contained that you're not going to find the success you want. And we're going to continue to spin our wheels and go, why aren't we fixing this? Well, one of it is we're not being realistic in what the problem is and how to deal with it.
And that's the thing. I mean, you know, this problem has obviously grown continuously over the past.
It's a chronic condition.
It's unreal.
We're taking
right.
out the chronic position. And when you're telling a certain agency, I'll give you $500,000, but in the 1 year of the program and the grant, you better show 70% success. That takes away from the chronic condition. You're basically telling that individual group that you better cure addiction.
True.
And how do they do that on their own? Because there's pieces. There's pieces of detox. There's pieces of stabilization. Pieces of whether it's medically assisted treatment or counseling or peer mentors.
Right.
There's pieces of what happens if someone does relapse. Can
these
they get back in the system?
These things are being developed now too. Like, so that's a beautiful thing. You know, I always circle about, because when you set the stage like this, this problem seems insurmountable, flat out to me. Like, as somebody who's in the middle of it, I look at it and I'm like, damn. I mean, at what point does this, you know, do we really start seeing some measure of success? And I use that word, and I did it specifically because of this. Like, how do we say that we're actually making a dent in this? I mean, on a micro scale, in situations and communities, there's things that are happening, and there are people that are changing their perspectives on it and being more involved and, you know, allowing people. I mean, just the compassion of it. We've talked about that, I believe, before at other times. But it's one of these things where I start to look at it and, like, something has to be done anyway, right? And while, like, I would say federally, those things move at a glacial pace. We know that, just like anything that's on the docket. But it is... It's almost, I know what my point was, but I sit here and I think to myself, what is it, what is our responsibility in all that?
Yeah, so the counter to that success is if you keep someone alive, that's success. If you get one person in treatment, that's success. And I often tell the story when I give a talk at the end, I often go off the starfish parable, which in the heroin opiate addiction community is pretty popular, in which young boys walking along the beach where tens of thousands of starfish have washed up on the ocean. And he knows if he doesn't get the starfish back in the water that they're going to die. So he starts picking up a starfish, throws it in the ocean, picks up another, throws it in the ocean, picks up another, throws it in the ocean. And there's this old man who's watching this young boy, and he comes down. He can't believe this young boy's doing this. And basically he says that, wait a minute, this is so insurmountable. There's so much. There's nothing you can do. You're wasting your time. Why are you doing this? And the young boy picks up a starfish, throws it in the ocean, goes, I saved that one. So that's the way we've kind of defined our successes. When we get a starfish and we throw it in the ocean, we save that one. But what about the tens of thousands of others?
And I'm glad you said that.
So then how do you deal with this? Is it one at a time? And if that's the case, then you got to look at the realism of this, that if you're saving one at a time, then you might be losing 10 at a time. So how can we take that one at a time and multiply it? and to a system that is able not just to save the one, but the multiple. And you have to change the view, and you have to look at it from, and I was just thinking about this the other day. Look what law enforcement's doing. We're piecemealing an addiction system. Law enforcement. Here we are not only advocating, but we're talking about diversion programs, treatment before arrest. Look what the sheriff's doing. Not only do they have a women's treatment pod, they're trying to work on a men's treatment pod. They now have the one-stop resource center in the lobby of the jail. We were just talking about this at the coalition meeting. This is astonishing. Think about this. 90 people walked into the Justice Center, not afraid of being arrested. Some walked out of the Justice Center coming out of jail, went to these resources. Me and other cops in uniform are kind of like the Walmart greeters. Here, come over here. This is where you get signed in. They'll help you get the service you want. Think about that.
It's beautiful, really.
It really is, but the problem with it is that you're looking at a criminal justice system that's trying to piece together a mental, medical health, chronic condition, and we're trying to piece this system together. So it goes back to we're having to save one starfish at a time because the system is not built for the masses. You don't have this with heart disease, with diabetes, with any other chronic condition, whether it's alcohol, sugar, food, caffeine, whatever it may be, whatever our addiction is, those generally go into the healthcare system. However, drug use does not. So here we are shifting from a law enforcement perspective, and we're having to piece it together. We're having to go to Congress and saying, wait a minute, this isn't working, that isn't working. When the whole time you have this incomplete mental medical health system over here that deals with chronic health conditions, but it's not being served in that system.
It's because of the criminality behind it. We know that, right? So that's the segue between the two. And I think, going back to your analogy in the starfish and understanding, like, my main perspective, because I was proposing that question really, not really hypothetically, but from the standpoint that I know that there are people that would say that. And I can sometimes even feel that way. But the reason that I go and I aim to help an individual, one, it helps me. There's no doubt that's I've seen that evidence in my life tenfold. But the other thing is I look at my own life and I say, all right, if it wasn't for the compassion that a judge showed me when I had no hope left, and she said, Mr. Lane, I have hope for you. If it wasn't for that situation, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing today, right? And I'm just one piece of this puzzle. But I look at everything that I've done, and I can measure that, and I can say, wow, I mean, here I've met all these people, I released this show, all of these things, and I was that same guy. So then you take for a moment that I'm not that special, right? That there are many other people that have something wonderful inside them, and if their life is saved, in turn, they're going to affect the 10, 15, and by a magnitude of 10, the people around them. Because that's a beautiful thing about how recovery works, and I see it in the lives of my own and lives of others, is that we have an outward impact on the people closest to us, which in turn will grab a piece of that and impact others. So that's why we do it, because I personally believe the more that we do that, all of a sudden you have this large number of people that have been affected, so now you're getting more starfishes picked up off the beach.
Yeah, think about this. Think if the beach was this resource center where tens of thousands of starfish get washed up, but part of them who get into the criminal justice system are able to be diverted into a chronic mental medical health system, whether it is treatment within the jail, whether it's medically assisted. Look at the jail. I got to give the sheriff's department a tremendous amount of credit. Medically assisted treatment right off the bat, a women's pod, working on a men's pod. They're connecting to treatment.
Right.
If you have an appointment somewhere else and you're being released from jail, let them know, and they will work on trying to get you to that treatment center. So they're trying to connect the pieces.
Awesome.
Just think if that beach had a place where if you went into a hospital, you got triaged from the beginning, you got stabilized, and then you were referred to long-term chronic care. Just think if that beach was a family or a parent who needed to get help for their kid. Just think if that beach was able to connect them right off the bat. You can get into an effective, efficient system that starts from the beginning to the end, whether it's revival or interdiction into recovery. Just think if that beach was that. We would not be saving one starfish at a time.
Right.
We would be throwing a lot of starfish back in the ocean, and that ocean signifies their life, going back to a better life, getting back connected to family, getting jobs again, getting back into the workforce.
Which affects all sorts of other beaches.
Which then, and the entire ocean.
Right.
We, society, are the ocean, and we're allowing these starfish to come up thinking, well, if we let them, they're the ones that
washed
up.
They'll just kill themselves off, and then that way we can, yeah.
Yeah, they washed up on the beach. It's their fault. But it still impacts us. That's less workers in the workforce.
In a lot of ways, we haven't seen yet either.
And think about the individuals. Think about you and others who have shined from this and said, you know what? I've gone from my past experience and now look what I'm doing. I'm advocating making a difference. If we didn't help you get back in, this would not be happening.
Correct.
This podcast would not be happening. You would not be touching the people that you're touching. So not each one of those starfish have a significant role in society, and we got to get them back in the ocean. If that beach was one big resource center, it wouldn't just be one little boy taking one at a time, throwing them back in. There wouldn't just be an old man sitting up there going, wait a minute, you're wasting your time. What it would be is tens of thousands of starfish would be back in the ocean because they would be connected to a system that looks at addiction as a chronic mental medical health condition. And no matter where you're at, just like we do with everything else, I mean, if you had a heart attack, guess who else shows up? The police.
Right.
We don't take you to jail. We help the squad. We get the cot out. We help carry their equipment. We get you loaded up. Just think if that system was connected with all the others when it came to addiction, we'd be a lot further off than where we are now. We wouldn't be wasting so much money on the front end. We'd be reinvesting on the back end. So I think we're at a foundation. This group, you were talking about you and the podcast and the work that me and others are doing. We're at the foundation of this. We are talking about this, saying this is what needs to change. And going full circle back into Congress and the congressional staff, that's what they're saying, is wait a minute, we need to be part of this because we have resources. Yeah. We have a tremendous amount of resources, not only funding, but research and great minds. How do we play a role in this? So this is the change. Even from the last time we talked, there's been significant change and significant inclusion from other groups who are saying, we need to be part of this. This is the front part of it. We are now going on the beach and we're looking at the starfish and we're saying we need to do a better job of saving these starfish, getting them back into active recovery in society. How can we do that as a system? What pieces do we need to connect? And where it was you standing on the beach or me or some of the other people with the coalition or people that have been working on this for 30 or 40 years who are standing on the beach, now you're starting to see other people who are standing on that beach.
With you.
You're starting
to see
Congress and Senate. The president, you're seeing the sheriff who's been from the very beginning, the Cincinnati Police Department, UC, University of Cincinnati, Mercy Health, Dr. Nov, Dr. Ryan, all these people are standing on the beach saying, wait a minute, you all need to join us and we need to connect as a system.
We need to do this together. And I think that's one of the coolest things, right? And since I did this, started this in February, and the amount of people that I've met, right? And now, and maybe I obviously, because it's a huge part of my life, I'm going to see it naturally more often than others. But I do believe that the numbers are increasing for people who are advocating for those who struggle. There's no doubt in my mind. And the way that it's being, you know, portrayed in the news is changing. And I mean, you know, every day, Channel 12, our local news station, is doing that segment on every once a week, showcasing another person who's doing things. And there's people like this popping up all the time, right? Now, naturally, there's some ugly in all of that. There's some people that are doing things for their personal fame. And and my opinion on that is if you take advantage of someone who's struggling with addiction, you can't call yourself a recovery advocate. I think it's a very strong position that I can confidently take and understand that that's going to exist, but that is not the majority of people who are doing this. The majority of people are changing their lives and in turn feeling the need and desire to give back, and that's the coolest thing. Now, I do want to switch gears for a second because one of the things that I'm always curious about, and we've talked about this briefly on other podcasts and then in person at times, but so the drugs that are out currently, right? Now, we've gone away from heroin. Let's just call, I mean, there it still exists, but not no way in that same shape or form. Usually, as it stands now, we're talking about fentanyl and analogs of that, correct? And then other designer drugs or synthetics. And now from a law enforcement standpoint and, you know, in your education, because I don't have the education of this. I'm just very curious is how, you know, this game of like cat and mouse or something, and they're just always coming up with something else because I keep seeing it in the news, like, you know, ECRA fentanyl and all these. You're like, what are you talking about? What is this? You know, drug resistant fentanyl or, you know, other things. So,
yeah, there's a couple things with this. So when I was speaking at the National Institute of Justice, I asked them to stop chasing drug trends.
Okay.
I get part of it. I get you want to know because if we didn't follow drug trends, we wouldn't have known about fentanyl, carfentanil. We wouldn't have seen this transition. So I get part of it. But there's such an emphasis on chasing drug trends that we never stop to deal with the real underlying issue of addiction. So there was heroin back in the 70s, and yeah, it came back, and now it's out again because the fentanyls have taken over. We got it in meth. There was meth back in the 2000, 2010s, And now it's back with a vengeance is what you hear. There's always this ebb and flow of drugs because the cartels and others like China putting fentanyl on the street, they're putting this product out. And it goes back to what I always say is a lot of people say that demand dictates supply. I disagree with that because I'm on my 11th version of iPhone. I never asked for the first. If you've ever heard of Beanie Babies and Cabbage Patch Dolls, no one asked for that. But yet right. people were fighting over that. So a lot of times, it, not only in the legal market, but also in the illegal drug market, you'll find that the supplier dictates demand. So you're always looking for what's the next drug that people will want? What's the next more powerful drug? What's the next more addictive drug? So the real trend for me is not necessarily whether it's heroin, meth, or cocaine. I mean, think about this. I heard this too. Cocaine's making a huge comeback. Let's put this in perspective. Pablo Escobar was bringing 70 to 80 tons of cocaine into the United States every month.
Right.
Back in the 80s, okay.
There you go.
70 right. to 80 tons. Cocaine never went away. Meth never went away. Heroin never went away. What you're seeing is a transition to more synthetics because from a business side, it's cheaper to make.
Oh, no doubt.
It's faster
pennies
to make.
Pennies on the dollar.
You don't have to grow it. Right. You can put it, make it in a lab, and it's more potent and more powerful, so more people are getting addicted. I spend less money on production. I make more money in profit because I can get more on the street, can make it quicker. So that is the trend, is turning to synthetics. But I think we got to be careful with chasing the trends. Because here's my, and it goes back to what we were talking about, success. We had success in the 70s when we quote-unquote wiped out heroin. We had success in the 80s when we quote-unquote wiped out crack cocaine. We had success in the 90s and 2000s with cocaine. We had success in the 2000s, 2010s with opiates. Now we've had success with prescription pills. And yet we still have just as many people in jail, dying, and using drugs than we've had in the history of our country. It's not necessarily the trends we need to be concerned of. We need to know about those so we can identify what's on the street. What measures do we need? Like with fentanyls and carfentanyls, what Narcan? And also what is myth and what's not myth? There's no such thing as a Narcan-resistant opiate.
Okay.
Narcan works on it all, but here's the problem with it, is as they become more powerful, what you'll find is you either need more Narcan to overcome it, or it's the timing. Timing and potency is a big deal.
Interesting. So, I think that's important for people to know.
Yeah. So, and we saw this trend when fentanyl hit the street, and you're right, there's thousands of different analogs of fentanyl. Thousands of different variations. The United States hasn't even seen probably double digits of those, but got there's you. Different combinations you can use of fentanyl. It's all still an opiate, all still works on the brain kind of like way. The opiate. Got it's just a matter of how long does it stay in the body. Some of the opiates travel through the body, the system, and some of them stay in the brain longer. What we always say, it's not Narcan resistant. The problem with it is Narcan can wear off, or you don't have enough Narcan in the brain to right. overcome that fentanyl. So the opiate molecule sits on the brain receptor. Then Narcan knocks it off. Mm-hmm. Narcan, depending on what doctor you talk to, lasts 30 to 90 minutes. Some of the fentanyls and synthetics of the opiates can last 2 to 3 hours in the brain. Carfentanil was never intended for humans, so we don't really have
right,
a measurement.
Type of measure for that.
So I tell people, and if they can follow along with me, is not everyone overdoses, gets Narcan, and just wakes back up and goes, hey, I want more to party and goes get more.
They were just the original source, like you've talked about before.
They overdose. Yeah. They re-overdose on the dose they already overdosed on.
Correct.
So,
and I know that from personal experience.
So there you go. And part of this is we have to understand that's the difference in the trend. It's not necessarily the drug being used. I think a lot of that, in my opinion, opinions, again, could be wrong, so I could be 100% my opinion.
No, but
it's only my opinion.
Bring out your opinion on when it comes to things of this nature.
And my opinion is a lot of times we focus on the drug itself instead of addiction as a whole, where we would work on those underlying...
Siri's listening to it.
It's having trouble figuring this out. So are we. I think a lot of times we chase these drug trends thinking that if we figure out that drug trend, we'll be able to somehow stop addiction. But we're never really working on addiction.
Right.
And I think that's what we're doing now when we talk about the starfish is us. We're saying, wait a minute. The drug, yes, it plays a role because when you're talking about revival, methamphetamine, people tend to be violent. So there's a different response from first responders. You got to be careful with that. People up for days. They may not be overdosing in a typical way where from an opiate where their heart rate's slowing down or their breathing
right.
stops. You have excited delirium when you're talking about drugs like methamphetamine, where the heart's so ramped up that you can have heart issues, have basically a heart attack. So there's different responses from that perspective, and we need to know what each one of those drugs do so we can figure out how to respond more appropriately. But when we're talking about how do we deal with this overall, you got to look at addiction as a whole. My vision is one day we're not separating who is using what. A lot of times we separate, and excuse the word, I could use user, substance abuse disorder, but let me use this. A lot of times we look at the quote unquote addict and what drug they're using, and we attach that to them.
Correct.
When in my theory is, why don't we look at addiction as a whole? Because the reality of it is, here's the real trend that people aren't picking up. And this is what I was talking to National Institute of Justice and others, ONDCP, all those, poly drug use.
Mm-hmm.
Did you just use one drug?
No.
There was alcohol, marijuana, no. Benzos.
It's rarely a cause for, you know. Yes, I used everything.
And unfortunately, I and a few others sit on an overdose review board where we look at people who have overdosed and died. And often it is not uncommon to find benzos,
correct.
Marijuana, opiates, and, fentanyl, alcohol.
And having
alcohol.
Experience with that, Tom, I mean, I can tell you this because I've talked about it many times, and it's intriguing to me because it goes into different areas. One, in my own life, I mean, I have traded substances for others, right? Where there was a combination of like marijuana and alcohol and benzodiazepines and, you know, and Adderall. I mean, all of it. The poly substance use has been a problem of mine for many years. So then when I get clean and sober, you know, the differences in the way that the withdrawal from them would make me feel, like the opiate withdrawal was vicious, right? But the psychological withdrawal from cocaine, which there's issues in terms of insurance from them saying, oh, it's just out of your system, not a big deal. There's no real withdrawal. Like, trust me when I say, having experienced it, you don't feel great for an awfully long time. No, you know, will to, you know, to do anything, no energy, no, I mean, sleep. I mean, like, there's a lot that goes with that. But I think further, you know, like even with the medically assisted approach, right? Currently, because one of the largest issues are opioids. When you look at that, and like, we can curb that, we can fill the receptors in the brain. We can make it so where you try to use drugs and it will not get you high. But then we're discounting the fact that there's other ones that people are going to be using on top of that because they know they can't use this one. They still want to get outside of themselves because I've had personal experience with this. So they're going to the methamphetamines or they're drinking or whatever it is just to get still. So I think we still have a couple years, or hopefully we can get it done this year and identify a way to counteract all of this.
Yeah, and we got to be careful. And you're 100% right. There, if you're using medically assisted treatment and it's blocking you having that desire in your brain receptor to get that opiate, it doesn't mean you're addiction free.
Correct.
You could be using alcohol. I hadn't seen crack cocaine in a long time, and we pulled up to somebody at Wendy's and they were crushing up a crack rock, and we're going, man, I haven't seen this in a long time.
Right.
What's going on with the crack? And they go, look, man, I was a heavy opiate user, but I'm on medically assisted treatment. I do not desire to have an opiate right now, but I'm still addicted.
Mm-hmm.
So I still got to have some type of drug.
So, wild.
So they were using marijuana, crack cocaine, yeah. Methamphetamine, using it all. We got a young kid in our town too, who switched. He's very open with us, but he had switched to meth because he was afraid of fentanyl.
Yeah.
And thought I was going to die.
I've met guys just like
but
this.
Here's the thing. I always had trouble with that because they're two separate drugs. One's an amphetamine. And the other one's a depressant.
Right.
So I always thought, man, can you really? And they're both extremely powerful. So can you just quit one and trade it for the other? And I thought, there's no way this is going to happen. And 3 weeks later, not only was that person now a meth user, but they went back to fentanyl, using meth, cocaine, fentanyl, that poly drug use. And what concerned me, and there's good and bad with all of this, and that's got to be the underlying factor in this. That's got to be the foundation. There's good and bad with all this. I hear people say, well, let people use fentanyl, but just make sure it's safe. Here's my only difference with chasing drug trends when it comes to fentanyl, carfentanil. There has never been a drug that is killing tens of thousands of people where you overdose pretty much immediately and have the potential to die immediately. And now it's being mixed with cocaine, whether unintentional or unintentional or intentional. Cocaine, methamphetamine, the poly drug use, speedball, what I call speedball 2.0 with the fentanyl and the cocaine. So now it's being mixed in other drugs where people aren't even opiate dependent. And now that fentanyl is going to a different market that's even more dangerous than what it was before.
Right.
That's the only separation from a drug trend, I think. And my concern is, because you hear it a lot, especially on the federal side, well, we seize more methamphetamine than any other drug. Well, number one, that's only what you caught. The United States only catches about 3-5% of the drugs that come into the country. So even if you're catching a lot of methamphetamine or cocaine, it doesn't mean necessarily that that's what's killing everybody. You don't need, the second thing with this is you don't need as much fentanyl to kill people. So you're not going to seize as much fentanyl as you are other drugs. And the problem with fentanyl is a lot of times it's in the needle or it's been snorted, it's gone. People aren't buying necessarily kilos on the street as a user of fentanyl because they're usually not making it through it. So we got to be careful with dropping the fentanyl trend and saying, well, fentanyl is not a problem. What it is methamphetamine or cocaine. We got to figure out what, number one, what drug is killing the most people, causing the most amount of overdoses, because in turn, that's what's putting the drain on the system, putting the burden on the system, whether it's financial, first responder, hospital, nurses, treatment, whatever it may be. That's, and it's obviously fentanyl and carfentanil. It is killing tens of thousands of people. If you look at the charts, the spikes are significant when it comes to synthetic opiates like that. Mm. And if there's thousands of versions, if we're only catching 3 to 5%, then that should be the priority. How do we stabilize, reduce the impact of fentanyl and carfentanil so then we get out of emergency mode and we start getting into that mode of dealing with addiction itself? So then it doesn't matter what drug we're dealing with. We're not going to label you based off what drug you like or what drug you're currently using, but look at the addiction as a whole, and can we build effective, efficient systems from the beginning of revival to interdiction all the way to recovery? That would be the ultimate goal. So I separate the two. I look at fentanyl and carfentanil as the emergency. We haven't dealt with it as an emergency. I've been saying from day one, from the local level all the way to the federal. Yeah, the
first time I talked
to
you, so we talked about that. Like, it has to be, like, this is needs to be addressed immediately.
It's got to be addressed immediately. We got to stop the tens of thousands of people dying. And especially with it spreading, that means now, and cocaine and methamphetamine, you have a different demographic.
You do.
It is the largest increase in overdose deaths we're seeing is the African American community.
Correct.
And a lot of it is being put.
And it's unintended. Like, it was like not intended for that to happen for it, them. Like, they were like, what are you talking about? I mean,
and it's spreading into meth. It's
right.
spreading into the other drug supply. And the problem with that is, as long as it continues to spread, we will stay in emergency mode. We've got to stop this emergency mode so then we have the ability to build systems. The systems are overwhelmed, whether it's the jail, whether it's the local police and fire department, juvenile foster care is
unreal. That's one of my biggest, it breaks my heart more than anything else. I say it in pretty much every beginning episode of my podcast, like the children displaced in the system because their parents are gone. Because now all of a sudden their grandparents can't take care of or whatever the situation is. We don't see this downline effect. Like, we know that it's happening and you've experienced with it. I've had experience with it because I have friends who have lost their children. Now their children are living in foster care. And from there, that causes more issues because they're also surrounded by people who were raised in a different, that type of environment. It's like what happens 5-10 years from now as this person starts to get older and this has been their life. And that scares me more than this, what's currently going on with individuals. And I get that there was, you know, this epidemic, which I also call pandemic. Now we've discussed that before, has gone so significantly that in the past 2 decades of, you know, you have this block of people that were being killed off, this certain age group, right? But my hope is still, as it hasn't changed, that my children do not go down that same route. Like, it's, we really should be focusing on that as well.
You nailed it. So here's part of the problem. Look, I'm not discounting that cocaine, methamphetamine, marijuana, benzos all have their inherent issues. They do.
Right.
The thing with those and why we as a society have blown off addiction for so many generations is because we've been able to excuse our way out of it.
Mm, true.
Because lot of times, whether it was cocaine, methamphetamine, or alcohol, alcohol impacts more people than all drugs combined.
Right.
But here's the thing. Usually it takes 20 to 30 to 40, 50 years before you see the impact, the devastation of it. And that allows us as a society to make excuses for it all. It allows us to push it off. For the first time in history, when we're talking about addiction and drugs, fentanyl and carfentanil forced us to look at all these underlying issues. It bubbled it to the surface, whether we liked it or not. There were racial issues, justice issues, economic issues, pharmaceutical issues. I always say this, when it came to OxyContin and the transition to black tar heroin, to heroin, to fentanyl and carfentanil, it was probably one of the only times in the United States where it was bad for you to have health insurance.
Right.
If you had health insurance, you were going to get sick if you were given prescription pills generally. And it helped us transition. So it brought all these underlying issues to the surface. But here's the thing. We can't excuse our way out of fentanyl and carfentanil. It's immediate in its overdose. It's immediate in its death. It's being spread to other drug supply. And you hit it on the head. Here's the problem. The longer we don't stop fentanyl, carfentanyl, the longer we let it go on and the longer we don't treat it as an emergency, we've lost another generation.
Right.
That is, and I gave this talk at University of Cincinnati, and I said the next generation, the younger generation, will be the one that changes the way we do this. Us now are just kind of laying the groundwork. And a professor came up afterwards and said, well, you know why that is? And I said, well, they seem open-minded. And the professor said, no, what it is they're the first generation who has seen their mother, father, brother, sister, son, daughter die immediately.
Right.
They will live with that forever. Their kids will be impacted. I have three generations of family impacted in my small town.
Mm-hmm.
And Maura Ware, who's part of the steering committee for the coalition, is the head of juvenile foster care. And she always corrects me. And I use her saying every time I travel and talk, we are literally four generations behind. Because there is another generation that's coming up that doesn't have a parent, that doesn't have a relative, that lost somebody to addiction. The longer we hold off and don't treat fentanyl, carfentanyl as an emergency, that's longer we don't get a system connected, a continuum care system that looks at addiction as a chronic mental medical health condition set up. That's longer that it takes that another generation will be impacted. We have to think of it this way. What is the generation that we're dealing with now? What's the impact on the next generation? And what is the impact on their generation? If we looked at it that way, we wouldn't get so bogged down in these other little things of chasing drug trends. Well, methamphetamine's the most that we catch. Cocaine's the most we see. That's irrelevant. I shouldn't say it's irrelevant. It's not irrelevant. It's still important, but we got to prioritize.
Right.
That's a good way to put it. Maybe it's not the emergency mode. Maybe it's down here where we need to, it's a priority, but right now the big priority is let's stop fentanyl and carfentanyl so then we can deal with the methamphetamine, the cocaine, the alcohol, the benzos, all these other issues that deal with addiction, the poly drug use, and let's have a system where people can connect on that beach where all the, when you get washed up on the beach, there should be a resource there that gets you back into the ocean the best way they can and make sure that you stay in that ocean with continuum of care.
Well, there we go. Well said, as always. I mean, I love how you put these points together. I love this analogy of the starfish and I believe that'll just be the name of this episode at this point. Well, I think it's just cool. You know, I admire you in the way that you deliver information, your compassion towards people, especially from your position in all this and how you were affected. I mean, even, you know, from the first time I met you and all the times we've run into each other in this entire process. But it just goes to show that, the important work that's being done, the magnitude in which we're faced with, but why you continue to do this. And I commend you on that. So I was curious here as, this year comes to an end. You know, I just want to ask you, do you feel as though we're making a dent in it? Or do you think where do you feel that we stand currently this year as opposed to the year before? Is that something we could at least say?
Yeah, if you're comparing data, and that's a lot of when you're talking about these programs out there, the good programs, and you're talking about grants, what you need is data. I was never a data guy, but I've been forced to be a data guy now in this system, because if you're going to get a grant.
You're like busting skulls. No, I'm kidding.
If you're going to tell a story, yeah, I'd rather, I'm the guy on the front line. Right. Yeah, the SWAT guy and that type of thing. But you got to have data, because that's what drives funding. That's what drives a lot of decisions that are made. Not only local,
the world we live in,
the state and the federal government. So if you look at it from a data standpoint, 2017 was obviously the peak. I don't know if there will be another peak. I feel bad because I go into meetings and I like to say I'm being realistic, but I sound like Debbie Downer all the time.
Okay.
But I'm always trying to be cautious because until we get that system that looks at it again, I sound like a broken record, but this is the truth. Until we get that system that looks at addiction, illegal drug addiction, as other chronic mental medical health conditions and treating that system, we're going to continue to see the backlash of addiction on our systems. So 2017 was the worst. We had almost 72,000 Americans die from overdose. Again, the more than all of Vietnam War, it dropped the life expectancy of an American by 2 months. We've seen small numbers, and you'll look at it anywhere from 4% to 22% of saving lives that we've been able to help people. So there you go again. Is that success? I mean, you keep somebody alive. That's correct. Pretty important. That is a success. But I always caution people, that didn't mean that someone got into active recovery. And my concern with that is, and like I said, for every good, there's a bad. It's good we got Narcan out there. We need to keep it out
that's
there. It is without a doubt a lifesaver. And when you're looking at numbers, whether they're 4 or 22%, you can directly correlate that to the biggest factor being Narcan on the street, whether it's from police, fire, or just civilians out there saving people's lives with Narcan. So that is significant in reducing. We are getting more people into treatment. But my thing is, we're working on the front end, which we didn't have before. So when you look at the overall picture, we now have a front end system that is saving more lives, trying to connect more people to treatment. So that's good. The next step is, and we can't declare quote unquote success, or we can't rely on just this being good news until we get people, more people into active recovery. My ultimate vision of this, and again, this is my, I could be 100% wrong and other people have different opinions, but I don't think we start seeing a shift until there's a higher percentage of people in active recovery than there is people in the front end.
So back to your analogy with the more people that we get to help get those starfish off the beach and back into the ocean.
Yeah, and you got to think.
That's the call to action.
Yeah, the good thing is you now have systems that are talking about this stuff that are connected more than ever. I do see in the future that on a federal level, the federal government will be much more involved. You will see a shift in policy from the federal side, and you've already seen it, but you'll see even more of a shift on how we view addiction and deal with addiction. I envision in our lifetime, we will see a president stand up and say that we need to view addiction as a chronic mental medical health condition it is and not just a criminal justice system issue. I do see that coming. On a local level, you're seeing this significant change from, like I talked about, the sheriff's department, other police departments, first responders, paramedics, hospitals, you're seeing this shift. Universities, you'll continue to see that shift. The problem is we're trying to figure out where all the pieces connect. We're rebuilding a system. So I do see that happening and continuing forward. My Debbie Downer part, my cautious part is we're saving more lives, but until we get them into active recovery and we're monitoring that and ensuring that someone, if they relapse, they're able to get back in that system easily, to continue that active recovery, what you're doing, and I hate, man, there's just no other way to say this. I hate saying it this way, but you're giving someone another day. If you Narcan somebody and they're not in that active recovery treatment, it's not all up to the system. Some of it is that the person that's addicted dealing with that addiction. If they're not in that recovery, there is a chance that the next time they use, they could overdose and die. So we've got to do a better job of making sure that when they wash up on that beach, that there is a way to get them into an effective, efficient system that is working towards that active recovery. It's not all on the system. Part of it is on those dealing with addiction. But as you know, with addiction, it's not like a lot of, I talked to a lot of people who said, man, I wanted to get help. I just couldn't.
Right.
It overpowered me. It overtook me. So how do you deal with the power of addiction, not having a system that's completely put together, having data that we're saving more lives, but are they on the back end? What's our data showing on active recovery? We really don't know that. And that's one of the things we're working on, both from the local, state, and federal side, is how do we measure that? How do we get people into that active recovery? And what's that real number? Because if we're saving 4 to 22% on this side, but only 1 to 3% are in active recovery, we know that there's a gap in the system. So how do we fix that? So when it comes to data, we're doing better. And I can't discount that, and I don't mean to diminish it. We would not be saving the lives we are. We would not be able to progress where we're going. And I guess when I look at success, that's my definition of it. To me, success is the continual pursuit to connect these systems to active recovery. If we're able to do that, then we make a bigger difference on the front end, the middle end, and the back end. So the data is, and the other negative part of the data is here in this region, Cincinnati, Hamilton County, we're still dealing with 50 to 70 overdoses every week.
Unreal.
So, and there's still on average 4 to 5 people dying every week. And it's not just us, Dayton, Columbus, Cleveland.
Right.
You're still seeing that issue underlying. So there's some people who could argue, well, wait a minute, you didn't reduce the amount of overdoses. And other people will argue, well, we saved more lives because the numbers are down overall from the total dying. And then other people will say, well, you didn't get them in active recovery. And then someone will say, well, I connected them to treatment. We weren't able to do that before. So you start really seeing the complexity of this. And I think we need to, redefine what we think success is. And instead of looking for success, we should have goals. And again, that continual pursuit of constantly working on how do we connect the systems and how do we change the stigma? How do we change the view and how do we make the public see it as a chronic mental medical health condition and how do we get people there? So the number, again, there is no easy with this.
No, I know that. And that's why, I mean, it's just, look, I thoroughly enjoy in analyzing these different areas because it is complex. You know, a gentleman that I had on my show about a month ago by the name of Keith Keller writes a book called The Infinite Recovery Handbook. Beautiful, well-written, you know, I'm about halfway through it. And, you know, when I've made a post about it after reading his book that talks about how, you know, addiction does not fit in one box. You can't just say it's this one thing.
Right.
It's many different things. And, you know, I mean, heck, even going to a 12-step meeting, they call it a spiritual malady. And I'm like, okay, so you add that to the list. All these different things. Well, it's something, right? We know that. We can all agree it's something. And it affects all different facets of life. And, it's going to take us to address it head on. So,
yeah. And the positive is we're talking about this now.
Yeah.
Could you imagine
that would never happen.
You talked about the first time we sat here and did this podcast. You're like, I can't believe I'm sitting here with a cop.
I couldn't either. But now I'm like, I get so used to it. I still get kind of freaked out when cops get behind me. I just can't help that. But I'm always waiting for like, hey, I'm buddies with Tom Simon. So, you know. Well, Tom, like, thank you so much. I got to wrap up. As I said, responsibilities day today dictate that I have to go get my kids. Hey, is there anything else you'd like to say?
Man,
thanks
for having me on. And please, people, just change the way you view and deal with addiction, man. Keep an open mind. Here's what I get out of this is we struggle. And I'm good with that. I wish more people struggled with their perceptions, their opinions, because if you did, you'd have more of an open mind. We need more open minds to find solutions. Stigma to me is just closed-mindedness. It just means that you didn't open the mind enough to hear other information. So I struggle with a lot of this, and I wish more people would struggle with it.
I love it. Tom, you are awesome.
Thanks,
to my
brother.
Listeners, and anytime, keep doing what you're doing. But as I say, do big things. Something like that. Even this hard saying, do bigger things. I'm saying that.